John Quinlan here with
Stephanie Woods.
And welcome to Ford Forum. We have a very special hour planned. Our guest for the full hour will be author Lev Rafael. He's going to be discussing his new book, My Germany, A Jewish Writer Returns to the World That His Parents Escaped. Just a really powerful work, don't you think?
Fascinating read. Yeah.
just, you know, on so many levels. You know, I think I was telling you earlier, I think for all of us, and, you know, we come to this time when we question how much of who we are is about who our parents were, what their mm-hmm. experiences were, how much of it is the choices that we make along the way.
I was really thinking about that, about how everybody's raised and what were our experiences are as a result of what our parents went through. And just reflecting on, obviously, Lev's experiences growing up, very different from my own, but just thinking yeah. about how my parents affect me and my life. And it was very powerful. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did too. Just many dimensions. I'm just surprised to, you know, nothing about this subject is uncomplicated. It was like a lot of the other things that Lev has written, actually, which are detective related books or ghost stories or some of the other things, and that there were twists and turns that, you know, in terms of the conclusions he drew or the perceptions he had about his parents and their experience, that just really surprised me. Not to mention just obviously the early chapters talking about what his parents went through in the context of that time.
When I first got it, I did what I think a lot of people do, is I went straight for the pictures. And I was amazed to find the picture of his mother's concentration camp uniform. I think I'd like to talk to him about that more in depth, but I think that'd probably be the first thing I'd burn.
Sure.
I don't know that I'd hold on to that, so I'm really curious about
it. I mean, and that's what so much is how much do you hold on,
right?
And how much do you let go, and how much do you let it influence as you move forward? And
it's going to be a good hour.
Some really good questions there. You know, the music that we opened with, by the way, that we may use again as we open some of these other segments, is from an exhibit that was here this last fall that many of our listeners are very familiar with. It was called The Nazi Persecution of Homosexuals, 1933 to 1945. The U.S. Holocaust Museum sent this out across the country as a traveling exhibit, and Madison was one of the places privileged to experience it. And Lev was the very inspiring and meaningful speaker on the last the closing ceremony of that exhibit. And the composition is by Adrian Torf, who it was a composer, also lesbian and Jewish in this case, who wrote just a very beautiful piece that, again, evokes all of these different moods and meanings and other things. And so, anyway, privileged to remember all of that and to start that. And one piece of resonance we want to mention is that the Gay-Straight Alliance for Safe Schools, who brought that incredible exhibit to town, is having what I think, for me, is actually one of the most inspiring and evocative of all the dinners that happen throughout the year for different organizations. It's called a Celebration of Leadership, and it's a chance to recognize some of the very courageous, groundbreaking young lesbian, gay, bi, and trans youth throughout the state who, even in this day and age when we think that somehow it's so much easier, really have to put up with some real challenges and really have to grapple with about what we're going to be talking about is, you know, being true to who we are at the core. And
That's hard no matter who we are.
That's for sure. But that dinner is coming up on Saturday, May 16th. It's going to be at the Monona Terrace this year with the 5 o'clock social gathering, 6:30 dinner and program. You can find out more about all of this by going to the website of gsaforsafeschools.org or calling 661-4141. And just a very important organization to support. Well, with that in mind, let's welcome our guest who will be joining us for again, the full hour. Lev Rafael is with us on the phone from his home over in central Michigan. And Lev is the son of Holocaust survivors and a pioneer in writing fiction about America's second generation, those who are children of those Holocaust survivors. And he published his first short story about children and survivors in 78. Many of his early stories on this theme were collected in an award-winning book called Dancing on Tisha B'Av. And since that time, he's been the author of 17 other books noting on the internet, just very pervasive in terms of reviews and responses and joining in the social discourse on sites like Salon and many sites specific to the Jewish experience, And he has keynoted at conferences, been an instructor, including over at Michigan State University, and also an outspoken youth advocate, I think, for LGBT youth and helping those young people deal with this experience of otherness and becoming true to who we are at the core. Hey, Lev, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's great to be here, and it's great to talk to you again, John. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. We haven't
spoken before.
No, it's great to have you on the show.
I'm glad you guys enjoyed the book, and I was thinking while you were talking and making your opening remarks, I was thinking that it's kind of a neat coincidence that in the fall, the theme for the Wisconsin Book Fair is going to be courage.
Oh,
really?
Yeah. Didn't know that.
And I was thinking, well, courage is never easy, no matter what field you're in or what it's about.
Yeah, and again, your book very evocative on so many different levels of what courage is all about and discovering those meanings. You're mentioning this Wisconsin connection with the book festival. I'm assuming that means you're going to be here with us. Is that
I don't know yet. No, they haven't picked the roster, but I have my fingers crossed.
Okay, and but one other Wisconsin connection here is that this book is published by our own University of Wisconsin Press.
Woo-hoo.
And we're very proud of that because. It is some of these powerful testimonials, the storytelling that, that they do so well. So, well, hey, I wanted to start out with maybe the passage at the very beginning of your book. You've said that you, as a writer, were always interested in writing stories, but you were never particularly interested in ghost stories as a child. And this theme of ghosts is something that's a thread that weaves its way through the book. Could you explain the significance of that?
Well, you know, my parents were haunted by their past, understandably, because their entire lives had been upended, and the world that they knew was basically crushed by World War II, by the Nazis, by the Holocaust, in terms of where they lived, how they lived, who they lived with. Their families were destroyed. And so growing up, it was impossible not to feel this presence around us of all the people who were no longer there. It really filled the gaps between sentences. You know, it was always there, always this presence of ghosts. And, of course, those were the good ghosts. There were also the malign ghosts, the Nazis and the Germans, the people who had done this to our family. So it really was a haunted house. And really, I never went into a haunted house at a carnival. I didn't like sitting around a campfire and listening to ghost stories. I never read them. I didn't want anyone to tell me them because I lived in one.
Well, it strikes me throughout the book. It's this duality. It's the fact that the Holocaust and the ghosts associated with it were this pervasive presence, and yet, you know, your parents didn't feel particularly motivated to talk about it very directly. It was much later in life that you were able to get in touch with some of those realities.
Right. When I did research on my own and actually while doing research for this book and interviewing my father, yeah, what I got basically was scraps, telegrams, you know, and this is something that's pretty common among children of survivors. So we grew up with a very patchy idea of what the war was like. Even as it affected our parents directly. And so we have to do a lot of work to put all the pieces together. And I think it's very fortunate for me as an author that I did write seven mysteries, because working on this book over a course of years really was like putting together a lot of different mysteries, following clues wherever they led. Sometimes they didn't lead anywhere, but sometimes they led in some pretty surprising directions.
Lev, in the book, you refer to another book that you wrote about German money, arguing about your mother's will. And I was wondering, as I was reading, is this writing cathartic to you, or why do you feel compelled to share these stories about your life and your parents' life?
Well, the German money actually is a novel about a survivor family, but it's not about my family. But I think for any author, writing is cathartic. Otherwise, why would we do it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do it to share something with an audience, but we also do it to find out what we think.
Mm.
You know, Wallace Stegner said, "How do I know what I think until I see what I've said?"
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true for all sorts of artists. I've talked to painters who say the same thing. They're not sure what's inside them until it's on the canvas.
Mm.
I think So that's part of the motive to create.
Well, there's so much territory to cover in the course of an hour, and we certainly want to talk about the experiences that both of your parents had, and again your own journey and what that meant for you as a member of the second generation. I guess I want to just to give our listeners a sense of the journey of the book itself, though, and the title, My Germany. Again, a Jewish writer returns to the world his parents escaped. Talk a little bit, if we could, about how Germany, you know, was and wasn't this pervasive presence in your life. And one of the things that I wanted to start with is actually a little bit further along, as you've described in the context of the book. You know, how there were other German Jewish German Jewish immigrants who surrounded you in Washington Heights, the neighborhood you grew up in New York, and certainly a lot of German presence, and yet you know your parents did not want to have anything that was German bought in the house. That was a bottom line, and there were some other bottom lines that were put down there about Germany being in this separate realm, this place that had caused so much pain and grief. And yet there was a point later in your life where you, I think in your college life, that you met a young German man, and there was an opportunity to study abroad in the summer. And your parents' reaction, as you quote here, was, I think it was your mom you were quoting, the Germans today aren't responsible for what happened to us. Actually, both parents said, and it would be good for you to have that experience. That just surprised me. It seems like
it surprised me. It was a real shock, and I didn't know what to do with it. And, you know, I did not grow up in you know, a Leave It to Beaver or a Hallmark card family where everything was talked over. Honestly, at some point at dinner or, you know, in the study or something like that, and everything was resolved very neatly. Things actually did not make a lot of sense for me growing up, and that was one piece of it. I mean, if we're not allowed to buy anything that was made in Germany, why would you think it would be a good thing for me to go to Germany? And I've talked to the second generation of people whose fathers fought in the Pacific War, and they grew up with similar feelings about Japan and anything Japanese.
Hmm.
Driving a Japanese car, eating Japanese food, and with also, especially if they were imprisoned or tortured, that this was a taboo radioactive country.
And you talk about in the book as a kid how the German records looked so enticing to you because they were so off limits.
Put your gramophone.
Right. Aren't all kids like that?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
What I was laughing about.
Have,
yes,
you know.
Exactly.
Hey, forget kids. How about adults? I mean, our whole culture is built around wanting what we can have, and look where it's brought us.
Well, absolutely.
Into this economic mess, right?
And we actually have a caller, John, on the east side. You're on Madison 1670.
Yeah, my question is this. Did you get a feeling from your parents about how pervasive the anti-Semitism in Germany was before Hitler took power? In other words, I understand what the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church did as far as fertilizing the field for anti-Semitism, but was it something that was below the surface, or was it pervasive even before Hitler took over?
Oh, very pervasive. Now, I have to make clear that the subtitle of the book refers to the world in a metaphoric sense, not just Germany, the European world that they lost, because my parents actually are Polish and Czech. And in both their countries, anti-Semitism was virulent, and they told many stories about beating and pogroms and things like that. So I grew up with the knowledge that not only had the Holocaust happen, but also that their lives before the Holocaust were not exactly secure. That's kind of scary for kids. Mm. You know, we want to give our children security. And as hard as you try, if the children know that their parents were imprisoned, you know, they may not understand a concentration camp, but were imprisoned, and somebody actually wanted to kill them, that's very disorienting information to grow up with. It's hard to make sense of it, because really you can't.
Well, in you know, as you're explaining, of course, your parents' experience wasn't specifically in the context of Germany, and maybe just to briefly introduce a little bit about each of your parents. So, in the case of your mom, it was actually in the city now known as Vilnius in Lithuania, but because the changing map of Europe was then Vilna, and in you know. is shocking. You know, to juxtapose this against the Holocaust, perhaps, you know, maybe seems that the things that were occurring there were on just such a different scale. And yet it still was a city where your mother kind of casually mentioned that some students had been attacked by people wielding boards with nails in them. And there were other pervasive examples of anti-Semitism and Jews being viewed as the other. And so this didn't just occur out of a vacuum, of course.
No, not at all. And historians have written about the pervasive Polish anti-Semitism between the two wars. So there, you know, the old country was certainly no paradise, but it still was home. And when your home is taken from you, both literally and metaphorically, that is a tragedy.
With your mother, in terms of feeling of home, she seemed to take a special pride in the city of Vilna and its heritage. Is that right?
Yeah, and it was a very, I think it's because she was an intellectual and it was a city that had a very rich intellectual life. People, apparently it was so significant a city that people from outlying suburbs would claim to be from there after the war, even though they weren't really from there. I mean, it's kind of hard to recapture that sense of something. But, you know, maybe it's like people who say they're from New York when they're really from, Westchester County or someplace like that.
Mm. And just to bring in a quality, I think you described really lovingly and yet, you know, with some element of critique. I mean, your mother was no one to tolerate posers or people who were pretentious about something.
No, absolutely not. No, she wasn't. And, you know, I should make clear to our listeners that the book really has a very strong positive arc.
Yes.
It explores the role of Germany as idea, fantasy, reality, in my life and in my parents' life, but it comes to some really surprising conclusions, and that's something that's been intriguing for me as an author, to meet people as they do signings who say that the book has made them rethink some of what they thought. And these are Germans and Americans, Jews and non-Jews.
Well, and without giving away everything or jumping right to the end, something that jumps out at me that I think would explain that aspect of it to our listeners is a relationship that you forged on one of your early book tours in the last several years with a young woman named Ulrike.
Ulrike, yes. Ulrike? Yes. A teacher, yes. I've felt a very close bond with her, partly because she's a teacher. You know, all teachers share the grading of papers and the student meetings and, you know, dealing with angry parents at some point or another. But she had some things in her past that made me feel close to her. When you go over there to Germany and you're Jewish and you're the child of Holocaust survivors and you meet someone whose parents or grandparents might have been or were, in fact, perpetrators, you form a very strange bond because you've both grown up in a household filled with secrets and silence, filled with things that can't be said. The unspoken is something that you know, is as common as breakfast cereal. So there's this bond across what seems like it would be a chasm of history, but it isn't. And I found that fascinating. I also have to say that it was amazing for me to be sitting and talking to people who were anguished about what their relatives, parents, or grandparents might have done during the war, and to think that I was actually very lucky because I didn't have to deal with that. I didn't have to live with that kind of shame in my own life.
Mm. You illustrate again, you know, I think in those later chapters, as you describe that journey back, it seems as if, to a certain extent, it wasn't nearly as traumatic as you thought. In many ways, you described it as more the sense of out-of-placeness you felt was more because you were an American traveling in a European city, and things like dining in a cafe across the street in Heidelberg from what had been one of Hitler's headquarters somehow just didn't have the emotional charge you thought they might.
I didn't. You know, I had no idea how I would react to Germany. I mean, I know Jewish friends who have said, you know, half joking but half serious, that they wouldn't even own a dachshund because they didn't know what its relatives had done during the war, okay? So I know people, of Jews and non-Jews, who would never step foot inside the borders of Germany. I'd always grown up thinking of it as, you know, the best image for me is is when Star Wars came out, and I saw Darth Vader and the Death Star. I said, well, that's the Nazis. That's what they would have done. They would have killed everybody they wanted to kill, and then they would have moved on and started destroying whole planets. And so for me to go to this dark, taboo place, I didn't know how I would respond. Ironically, I responded more as an American than a Jew or as a son of Holocaust survivors. And I think this is probably more typical than what you might think for American writers. James Baldwin famously wrote about how going to Paris made him feel more American and less black because people treated him as an American. They weren't thinking of him as black.
Mm.
And it also gave him better perspective on his life in America and race relations in America. And I really felt much more like an American traveling there than I did like a Jew. Even when I went to the site of a concentration camp, as moving as it was, I still was very, very much aware of my Americanness because the Germans are quite different from us.
Yeah, I think there's another important distinction you make in those chapters. It's that it wasn't so much that you were going there to see how Germans would assess or judge who you were. You were there to figure out, in some sense, how you felt about them.
Absolutely, and how I felt about myself in Germany. I mean, this was the forbidden planet, and here I was landing on it. You know, first I went on a research tour, and then I went on two book tours, and sponsored by a German publisher, and the experience was pretty amazing. People had always told me, authors had always told me, you know, you really should get your books translated into German because the Germans treat authors wonderfully. They treat them as important cultural figures. You know, you're not author number 725 being shuffled through Barnes & Noble. You know, you speak at great venues like museums and libraries, and they will listen to what you say and ask good questions. And I thought, well, that's fine for you, but I would never do that. And then through the circumstances described in the book, I ended up doing just that and finding out that it was really true. And so that was very fulfilling for me as a writer. And I learned a lot about myself, and I learned a lot about Germany. Which is partly what the last part of the book is, because I conceive of the book as a memoir/travelogue.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a moment.
And welcome back to Ford Forum. John Quinlan here with
Stephanie Woods.
And a guest on the phone from Central Michigan is Lev Raphael. He is the author of My Germany, A Jewish Writer Returns to the World His Parents Escaped. Lev, we wanted to. It's very easy in this book, and the different ways that the themes weave together to be pretty stream of thought about this. But I want to return to, I guess, a little bit more of a chronological order again, and again, just give our listeners a better sense of who both your parents were, and of course, what their experience was specific to the Holocaust. I'm going to start with your mom, and I know Steph has some specific questions about your dad in just a second. But how old was she at the time of the Holocaust? And your mother has passed away. How long ago was that? And you just maybe trace a little bit the journey of times in which she did open up and share about this. Just kind of, you know, anyway, how that interaction with her proceeded.
Well, she was 24 when the war was over. She was born in St. Petersburg during the Russian Revolution, and her parents had to flee with her to family in Vilnius at the time. And she was caught up in the Vilno ghetto and then was one of only about 1,200 or 1,300 women who survived and was taken to a concentration camp in Riga, Latvia, then to camps in Stutthof, and wound up in Germany for the last almost year of her war years in working in a slave labor camp. My father was from the Carpato, Ukraine, which is now in the Ukraine, but was then part of Czechoslovakia. And his part of Czechoslovakia was taken over by Hungary. And like thousands of other young Jewish men, he was forced to be a slave laborer in the Hungarian army, digging trenches, building roads, etc., on the Eastern Front. And he had a wild series of adventures and near-death experiences there, and ultimately was captured and ended the war in the concentration camp of Bergen-Belsen. And then my parents met at a DP camp, a displaced persons camp in Germany, not so far from Magdeburg. And each one of them had experiences that are, when I think about them, are so astonishing. I can't imagine surviving them mentally. And yet they did. I mean, they were in a pretty good mental condition. And it used to astonish me sometimes when I'd read growing up about parents who were physically brutal to their kids, you know, chaining them to radiators, burning them with hot irons. And I'd look at my parents and I'd think, they're really normal compared to that.
Yeah. Well, and as you said, just a rich life as intellectuals, as people who are multilingual, very aware of their world, and yet this contradiction you describe as well, that in many ways they pulled back from the world at large to this familiar circle of friends who shared this experience.
Well, I have to say my dad grew up on a farm, so he was not an intellectual.
Okay.
And this is a common match that you find in the Holocaust, where people from wildly different backgrounds. My mother, you know, from the intelligentsia and well-educated, marrying someone who is not, and from parts of very different parts of Europe. And I think, you know, at the end of the war, people were desperate to create some normalcy and have a new life. And they moved in together the first night they saw each other.
Ken, we'll continue to add in just a second, but just give our listeners a flavor of some of what your mother experienced and then how she processed that. You tell a story about your mother vis-a-vis her own mother and what was unfortunately a common experience, a situation where people were drawn into two lines that ultimately determined their fate.
Right, and she wanted to go with her mother because at that point people knew what the different lines meant, and her mother pushed her back on the other line. So her mother, in effect, saved her life, and she knew what that meant. So, you know, how do you live with a reality like that? I mean, how do you go on? And yet she did, and they started a new life after the war in Brussels, and then started another life when they were able to emigrate to the U.S. I find that amazing. It's certainly a profile in courage.
And in her case, you know, again, in case of both parents, not necessarily talking about these experiences in detail, but you discovered many years later that about 8 months after this experience, she had written a piece for a Jewish journal that described much of this in fairly graphic detail.
Yes, it's pretty amazing. I found something that has never before been published in English. She wrote it in Yiddish. It was published in Paris in the fall after the war, and it's sort of an essay letter about her experiences or some of her experiences in the war, and it's pretty shocking and amazing both. And she never told me that she wrote it, and as far as I know, she never told my brother that she wrote it. And I, the book explains how I actually uncovered it, but it turns out it was in a library in Paris, a Jewish library in Paris. And, you know, it's not exactly a Dan Brown book or national treasure, but I did feel in my own way that I was discovering documents and learning things that were totally unknown to me and were kind of mind-blowing.
And with your mom, is it fair to say that many of these revelations and in some ways the conversations that you had with her were posthumous ones? They were after her death.
Yes, and I think that's the problem for many of us when our parents die. And this really is a baby boomer book because I think we're at the age where we're looking ahead to what we're offering and leaving to our children and maybe even grandchildren and looking backwards to where our parents have been. And unfortunately, you know, we learn what the right questions are too late often, and the person or persons who can answer the questions are dead. Mm. I've heard this from many people who've done genealogical or family research, totally disconnected from the Holocaust, and they said, you know, they uncovered mysteries that can't be solved because no one knows the answer anymore.
Lev, I'm really curious. I was so surprised. I did mention at the beginning of the program that there's a picture of your mother's last concentration camp uniform. How were you able to acquire that? Was that something she held on to?
She held on to it, yes. It was hanging in her closet, which
wow.
is pretty astonishing.
Yeah.
She never talked about it. And I don't think, I don't even remember seeing it more than once. But I think I picked up that you don't talk about this. I mean, it was very clear. This is not something we talk about. But I'm sure she kept it as a memento is the wrong word, but
yeah.
as a sign of what she went through. You know, that was where she was and where she had been and where she was now was someplace completely different. Of course, had she not saved it, I would not have learned as much about her past during the war as I did because the number on it helped me trace her
right.
from camp to camp.
Right.
Do I remember one of you, either she or you, I think framed it as sort of a symbol of liberation. I mean, that's sort of out of what you're saying there, but
right,
does that make sense?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Rather than something to burn. Because, again, when I first saw that, I was glad to see an example in print. You know, I hadn't seen one before. And then at the same time, I went, wow, she held on to that. Why do you think that? I guess you sort of answered that already, but I would imagine that would be something she'd want to get rid of, but...
Right, my father did not keep...
He didn't keep his.
No. So I think this meant something to her. It's also possible that, you know, in a romantic way that they wouldn't say, maybe that's what she was wearing when she first saw my father.
Mm.
I don't know.
Mm.
Again, here's a question that can't be answered. And I honestly don't know if she were alive, if she could answer it. Because, you know, she would be looking back at 60 years and how much would have changed in terms of how she was interpreting the past. You know, would she really remember exactly what she thought in those amazing, crazy days when the Magdeburg was being bombed by the Allies and the Germans fled from the camp and there was a forced march and there was just so much chaos and destruction. I mean, how much do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't mention it in the piece that she published, so I think that's kind of significant.
This is Forward Forum. We're speaking with Lev Raphael, the author of My Germany, A Jewish Writer Returns to the World His Parents Escaped. Lev, in reading about your father, before you kind of go into depth about his experience, I liked the advice that your grandfather gave to your father, saying even during a war, even if you're in prison, a shoemaker or a tailor will always have work and something to eat. I thought that was interesting that he, I don't know, maybe planted that seed. And I found his story, your dad's story, as he went throughout this time, just fascinating. Will you share a little bit about what he went through between, you know, wearing the Hungarian soldier's uniform to escaping and then, you know, going back to the camps?
Well, you know, he was a redhead, and there's a lot of superstition in Eastern Europe about redheads. And that may have been all it took for the Hungarian officer supervising his work battalion to hate him, because this guy tried to kill him at least twice, and he survived a hand grenade being thrown at him,
right.
He survived being beaten almost to death, and he was actually left for dead. He was covered with so much blood that everyone thought he was dead, and he crawled back to the barracks and or wherever they were being housed. And he also almost was shot by a Nazi who, I don't want to say what happened because I think readers should read it for themselves, but someone who just quirkily decided, oh, I won't shoot you today. And then he had hairbreadth escapes and finally sort of gave up and let himself be captured and was taken off with a lot of other Hungarian Jews, and at that point to Bergen-Belsen, which was, how do you compare the camps? But that's one that we know because the British photographed what it was like when they liberated it, and there were just piles and piles of corpses everywhere.
Your father had a special role at Bergen-Belsen. I believe the word you used is capo, and you were struggling to discover exactly the meaning of that. It sounded like it was something very negative, although later you discovered it could have a positive.
Well, I did a lot of research on that, and especially with people at Bergen-Belsen, and they said that there were good ones and there were bad ones. And Most were bad, most were criminals, but he wasn't. And he, actually, there were many people who were grateful, as I described them, and grateful to him for what he was able to do to protect them. That's how my mother saw him the first time. He was being borne around this displaced persons camp on people's shoulders who were cheering when they saw him again because he had saved their lives.
You write,
but that's something that he never mentioned to me. I mean, he was very taciturn, and he would never talk about saving anyone or doing anything to help anyone. That just was not what he would say until I told him I was writing the book and doing research, and then, you know, he would say things like he would get extra food for people. And you know, you have to think about it. He said there were these poor Romanian boys who were always hungry, and I'm thinking, well, wasn't everyone always hungry? Mm. But he couldn't explain, and maybe didn't want to explain, why they were so much hungrier than anyone else.
You know, what you're reflecting on is just strikes me as just one of the most powerful aspects of the book, and it's to both acknowledge how this experience made your own relationship with your parents difficult, made you know, affected them and the way that they responded to the rest of the world. You have this phrase in which you refer to my father's general taciturnity, his coldness, everything I disliked about him, tracing that back to the Bergen-Belsen experience. And that made our relationship difficult. He himself was not only a survivor, he had lost his father when he might have been saved. I was telling Stephanie, it reminds me of a biography that Gloria Steinem had written a couple of decades ago. And Gloria had grown up with a mother who was severely mentally ill and had to become an adult at an early age, and many other aspects of that she goes into in great detail and doesn't hold back from. And yet there is this feeling of unconditional love and affirmation about what her mother went through. It's very empathetic and very understanding of the things that made her mother who she was. And it just seems that that power is throughout your book.
Well, thank you. I was very pleased when people or reviewers would tell me that they thought the book was very loving, because I didn't write it with that intention, but that's where I wound up. I mean, I had so much more compassion for my parents than I'd ever had before writing about what happened to them. But you know, we in the second generation grew up with a very strange dynamic, because our parents were even more overprotective of us than Jewish parents might be in general, because of what they had suffered. And yet in a lot of ways, we had to take care of our parents as well, because they were so vulnerable and there were things about them. They were wounded. And they, in turn, were aware that we were not growing up normally. I mean, they knew it. I mean, I've talked to survivors who said, you know, I was lucky because I had a normal, relatively normal childhood, but my son or daughter didn't. I grew up with parents who weren't in a camp. My son or daughter did. And that changes everything. And I think we all struggle with what that inheritance means to us, and we come to different conclusions spiritually, religiously, culturally, and make our own way in the world with a bit more of a burden, say, than other people might. But I'm expecting to see, you know, we share commonality with all children whose parents have been through disasters, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's the Armenian genocide or Cambodia or Rwanda or anything else, even something like Katrina. I think we are going to be seeing literature come out of there where people will be talking, writing about how their parents were damaged by what happened to them.
And you don't find it to be any way diminishing of the Holocaust experience to be able to make those analogies?
Not at all. Not at all. No, I'm not saying that Katrina was a Holocaust or that the Holocaust was a hurricane and a storm and a flood, but I think that there are things that all of us whose parents have survived tragedy can share and talk about, even though there are profound differences.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that resonance, you know, elevates the Holocaust, makes it relevant in the here and now, and makes it possible for us to learn those lessons.
Well, let's face it, the Holocaust is not a Jewish tragedy or German tragedy or Polish or Czech. It's a human tragedy.
Yeah.
It's part of human history. part of Western history. It must be understood, and, you know, there's always new information coming out about it, like things that I discovered and wrote about in my book.
Absolutely.
Madison, 1670, WTDY. This is Forward Forum. We are speaking with author Lev Raphael, author of My Germany, A Jewish Writer Returns to the World His Parents Escaped. You can go online to check for a schedule of his upcoming appearances at www.levraphael.com. We'll be back with your calls, 321-1670, *123, in just a moment. Madison, 1670, WTDY. This is Forward Forum. I'm Stephanie Woods. And I'm sitting here with John Quinlan. We are speaking with author Lev Raphael, author of My Germany, A Jewish Writer Returns to the World His Parents Escaped. If you would like to participate in the conversation, please do give us a call, 321-1670 or *123 on your U.S. cellular phone.
Lev, I'd like to, just in our remaining 10 minutes or so, you know, and feel free, by the way, to refer back to earlier sections of the book. But I think it is important for folks to understand the full arc that you take here. And at some point during your visit to Germany, I think you essentially make the reflection that part of that trip and part of some of what you saw and experienced there essentially allowed you to kind of to lose some of the burden of the Holocaust experience, in the sense that it limited you or prevented you from fully experiencing your world. Anyway, let me start there. Is that essentially part of what happened?
Well, that's part of it, definitely. I felt like I really let go, traveling around Germany, finding myself enjoying meeting Germans, speaking to Germans, appearing in various venues, and negotiating my way around as an American traveler using German, even speaking German became enjoyable. But you know, the commercial we ran for Cinco de Mayo made me think of how important it was for me to share meals with Germans, to sit down at a table, because that's a very profound bonding experience, to sit down with someone and share a meal and everything that it evokes. And even, you know, in German restaurants, strangers will sit down at a table if the seat is empty. And I had great conversations with people who I just met, you know, total strangers, not just people who were hosting me in the city or taking me around or who had come to hear me speak. And that really meant a lot. To me, the book really is about letting go. And again, as I say, isn't that what baby boomers have to do? I mean, we have to let go of a lot of our past, and we have to understand it, but we also have to let go of old wounds before we truly grow up.
You know, it sounds like, again, a dichotomy here, that part of this was discovering the ordinariness and the beauty of what Germany and the German people could be capable of, but some of it also was discovering in the context of Germany some of these memorials and some of these remnants of the Holocaust. One of the things that you quote that you found especially appropriate and touching was in the Holocaust Tower, something cold, concrete, gray, with a slash of light hopelessly far away, which said, "You are alone. Your cause is hopeless. Nobody will save you."
Sorry, that's the Jewish Museum in Berlin. Very okay. Evocative, very evocative tower that, as you say, makes you feel some of the feelings that people might have felt in the Holocaust. But you can walk out, you know, and they can't. And likewise, the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin is just astonishing, because you, as you enter it, you get more and more disoriented and more distanced from people around you and the city around you, and you're not exactly lost, but there's always that possibility that you might be, and I think that too is evokes a lot of feelings and perceptions about the war.
You being who you are, you certainly aren't recommending that this is the path everyone has to take or that it's the only legitimate path, but what something that brings into clarity the fact that not everyone has the same experience in terms of the way that they view Germany was an experience that you describe in the the epilogue to the book, going into a Jewish community center and, among other things, announcing that perhaps now was a time to move on to projects that weren't related to the Holocaust and this feeling of having had a burden lifted. For some folks, that struck them as somehow fallen into the same trap that of course, they felt the world had fallen into of discounting and not doing proper homage to the experience of the Holocaust.
Well, you know, they were those people who objected were not ready to move on. And I wasn't talking about my experience in any prescriptive way. I was simply describing what I had felt, and that really shocked and angered some people. But interestingly enough, that was before the book came out. I've been speaking in a lot of Jewish venues since the book came out, mm-hmm. and I have not encountered that reaction. So I'm wondering if it's something about having a physical book that makes these perceptions more authoritative, or certainly evokes more respect for them. Oh. I don't know.
That's interesting. I mean, just to relate one other part of this, again, just to say how profound these feelings were, there was a young German woman who stood up in the audience, and you said you could feel several audience members around her kind of become hostile and distant. And what she said was quite striking. She said, of course, Jews went to Germany and should continue to do so because Jews were a profound part of German history and culture. Anyway, regardless of maybe the incident or the reaction, is that something that you found other Germans of your generation anyway able to reflect back on?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, unlike France, which has done hardly enough to acknowledge wartime collaboration, I think Germany and many Germans are working very, very hard through memorials, through Holocaust curricula to make sure that this history is not forgotten and is understood in every possible way. And I've met many people who are actively engaged in this this act of historical memory, and I find it pretty impressive and amazing. Even, you know, Germans who have nothing to do with the war through their family, for instance, they just feel like this is something that has to be done, and I respect that. I admire that.
Could you summarize as best you can? We're probably about 3 minutes before the end of the interview, though. Then, in general terms, upon these trips back to Germany, your feelings about the German people that you met, about the country itself, you know, has it truly moved forward as a democracy? What kinds of perceptions have filled in all those negative things you once felt?
Oh, I think it's undoubtable that it has. That doesn't mean that anti-Semitism is gone. It doesn't mean that there isn't a strong neo-Nazi movement there. But I think that it is certainly a very liberal, progressive country, quite unlike what it was before the war. And I think people working to learn the lessons of history, which I guess every country has to do. It doesn't mean that every country does. I mean, look at Japan. Japan having difficulty acknowledging how they treated Korea during the war. That's going to be a struggle that those two countries are going to be going through for quite a long time.
You know, again, your story is these dual meanings in the sense of moving past a legacy that in some way weighed you down, but also it seems like it's a lesson for a lot of us who still have this opportunity to learn from the experience of our parents, learn who they are, and develop deep insights into who we are in the process. Is that a journey that you'd recommend to others?
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest mysteries we all grow up with is who were our parents before they became our parents. We really don't know. I mean, no matter what they tell us, that's not the real story. They were very different people before they met each other and before they became parents. And I think finding out who they are is really something very joyful. No matter how much sorrow might be involved in it, it tells you who you are and who you might be.
All right. Stephanie, last thoughts?
I'm just so glad that we had you for the hour, Lev.
Oh, I was very glad to be here, and it's great to talk to John again.
All right. And I assume you have some greetings, perhaps, for folks you had a chance to meet in Madison last fall?
Hi to everyone that I spoke to at before, after, and during the synagogue, and you all know who you are. The list is too long. I don't want to turn into Halle Berry at the Oscars.
Well, thanks so much. The hour has flown by, and we hope you'll join us again. And maybe
I would love to do that.
It sounds like the journey is ongoing, so many more tales to tell.
Yes, I think so.
All right, take care.
Take care.
Again, we've been speaking with Lev Raphael, the author of a fantastic book, My Germany, A Jewish Writer Returns to the World His Parents Escaped. You can find out more on our website, our blog. If you go to forwardforum.net, you'll have links there. Also directly on Lev's website, which is levraphael.org. Should be a fun show coming up next week, talking about a bunch of things, local politics and Mother's Day. Join us then.